is Tuesday, June 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. Supreme Court upholds President Donald Trump's travel ban. Iran's president seeks to reassure the public following Monday's protests, and a dead World War II soldier receives the highest military honor. It's all ahead. The U.S. Supreme Court Tuesday upheld the Trump administration's travel restrictions on citizens of five majority Muslim countries, handing President Donald Trump a victory in enforcing one of his most controversial policies. VOA Justice correspondent Masood Farivar describes to me the significance of the decision.
Well, it depends who you talk to. You know, for the president and his administration, it is a major victory. You know, this is an outcome the president wanted to see all along after more than a year of court battles all over the country. The president sees this basically, the majority, as a victory for the American people and his national security agenda. Now, immigrant advocates and others clearly don't share that view. They see it as discriminatory and an affirmation of what they call a Muslim ban.
It was a narrow decision, you know, 5-4, like many major Supreme Court cases have been recently. What did the majority cite as among the main reasons for upholding the travel ban?
Well, the case kind of basically centered on the president's authority, on presidential authority, and whether the president has the power under U.S. law to ban a certain class of foreigners from coming into the country. Now, under the 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act, the president does have the power to restrict the entry of certain aliens that, quote, would be detrimental to the interests of the United States. That was the government's argument, and the five justices in the majority basically agreed with that argument. Another reason that they put forward was that the plaintiffs in the case, the state of Hawaii and the Muslim Association of Hawaii, failed to demonstrate that the travel ban violated the U.S. Constitution's Establishment Clause, which kind of bars favoring one religion over another. So there are two major reasons, but the main one centers on presidential authority.
But now, what did the minority opinion say about the travel ban?
Well, the four justices in the minority wrote very scathing dissents in the case. They clearly did not agree with the court's ruling. One dissent kind of stood out, and that was written by Justice Sonia Sotomayor. And she said that she was troubled. She found troubling the parallels between the reasoning in this case and the infamous Korematsu v. United States case. And that was a 1944 Supreme Court ruling that affirmed the U.S. government's authority to put Japanese Americans in military internment camps during the war. So that was her opinion.
The nations that are included in the travel ban have changed over time. Why is that?
Well, it's been really difficult to keep track of them, but initially back in January 2017, the president's travel ban included seven Muslim countries. Then Iraq was dropped. And eventually in the third and current travel order, there are five Muslim countries: Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. And also two other non-Muslim countries, North Korea and Venezuela. Now, North Korea and Venezuela were added, according to some observers, to make the ban more difficult to challenge as a Muslim ban. Chad was another country that had been added to the current order, but was recently dropped after the administration said that the Central African country complied with information sharing requirements.
What have civil rights groups and human rights organizations said about today's decision?
They have strongly denounced it, but they're saying that they'll continue to fight. They haven't said how they're going to keep up the fight. Keep in mind that the Supreme Court ruling that was handed down today is now the law of the land. It effectively puts an end to the controversy over the travel ban. There are no additional legal recourses for opponents of this ban to turn to, but they have said that they will continue to fight.
VOA Justice Correspondent Masood Farivar. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. The European Union sanctions 7 Myanmar generals over a Rohingya crackdown. Eritrea sends a high-level delegation to Ethiopia. Deadly flooding occurs in northern Vietnam, and 4 people are wounded in a rare shooting in Hong Kong. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
When receiving needed medications, most people, if given a choice between taking it orally or by injection, often choose the less painful method and take a pill rather than get stuck with a needle. However, people with type 1 diabetes who are dependent on insulin don't have such a choice. Every day, diabetic patients must get their doses of the life-saving substance by injection because there's no way of taking insulin orally. But that could change soon, as researchers at Harvard have developed a new insulin delivery system that allows patients to forego the shots in favor of taking the medication orally. The researchers have been able to overcome multiple physical obstacles that have prevented orally delivered insulin in the past, such as the stomach's acidic environment and that insulin is poorly absorbed from the intestines. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the wife of a deceased World War II soldier will accept his Medal of Honor. American motorcycle maker Harley-Davidson announced Monday it is moving production for its European customers overseas to avoid European retaliatory tariffs after the U.S. imposed duties on steel and aluminum imports. President Donald Trump tweeted his surprise that it was the first company to wave the white flag. The president defended his get-tough trade policy during a campaign appearance late Monday in South Carolina.
Our country lost $151 billion. They send the Mercedes, they send BMWs, they send everything. We tax them practically nothing. We can't send our cars. And if we do, they charge many, many times the tax that we stupidly don't charge. So I told them, here's what we're going to do. We're going to charge a tariff on steel until such time as you straighten out your act and you let us have fair. They don't let our farmers into the European Union. It's very hard. So we have farmers that want to sell. The European Union has what they call trade barriers. The European Union doesn't allow our farmers to go and trade. It's very hard for them to go trade. And if they do, it's very expensive. So I want the barriers taken down. I want our farmers to be able to trade. I want to be able to sell cars in there just like they sell cars in here. And it's all going to work out.
The U.S. is also preparing to impose tariffs on billions in Chinese imports as a result of the bilateral trade imbalance, forced technology transfers, and market access. Gary Huffbauer, a non-resident senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, Harley-Davidson's decision is a result of the Trump administration's trade policy.
The fact of the matter is that if you're a company, a multinational company, and you're selling products all over the world, and if you sell products from the United States, you're going to be facing with retaliatory tariffs on your sales in some markets. But in addition, the U.S. is going to put tariffs on some of your inputs. In the case of Harley, it's steel, specialty steel that they use, and some aluminum. That puts you at a huge disadvantage. And many companies are facing exactly the same thing. They probably won't announce what they're doing, but this is one absolutely predictable result of this trade policy that President Trump is following.
So you're expecting other companies to follow?
Oh, absolutely. They have. I'm sure they have already. They just haven't talked about it.
At the same time, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said that forthcoming investment restrictions will not be specific to China, but will apply to all countries that are trying to steal our technology, trying to rebut media stories that China was being targeted.
Well, of course China is being targeted. But of course, It's been a widespread problem. It goes back really to the Clinton administration or even before. It's true that the way the regulation will be phrased, it will apply to any country. But Steve Mnuchin is trying to do what Treasury Secretaries often do, which is to smooth over frictions. But the reality is the reality.
At the same time, China told France on Monday it will buy more of European farm produce, possibly future Airbus purchases, and pledged to work market access, shoring up its trade ties with Europe amid the increasing danger of a tariff war with the U.S.
This, again, was quite predictable and was predicted by many people, and I was one of them, that China will try to keep very good relations with Europe and with Japan and Korea to the extent they can and with other countries. And this is just a very visible statement of what was inevitably going to happen. And the special feature of China is that it doesn't matter if they have to pay somewhat more for wheat or buying soybeans from Brazil, for example, or buying Airbus rather than buying Boeing. If they have to pay somewhat more, so what, given their economy? Because this is not, you know, individual companies. This is the state basically saying, this is how we will respond to the United States. And so they will do it. And U.S. companies and U.S. farmers will unfortunately lose.
Gary Huffbauer of the Peterson Institute. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani insisted in a speech Tuesday that the country's economic situation is not as dire as many claim it to be, and that Tehran is fighting a psychological war with the United States. Rouhani's words came a day after businessmen in the capital of Tehran shut down the country's iconic central market to protest the declining value of the Iranian currency, the rial. The rial, which started the year at 43,000 to the dollar, is now trading at about 92,000 to the dollar on the black market. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Amateur video showed hundreds of Iranians chanting death to the dictator and the United States is not our enemy during a second day of protests Monday, in which businessmen closed down the country's iconic central market, the bazaar, for the first time in nearly 40 years. Many Iranians are upset about the declining value of Iran's national currency, which has lost more than half its value since the start of the year. In a nationally televised speech Tuesday meant to reassure the Iranian public, President Hassan Rouhani claimed the country's economic situation is not as bleak as some are making it out to be, and that the current crisis over the value of the national currency, the rial, is linked to an economic and psychological war with the United States. Rouhani asks why people are suddenly worried about their economic future now. He insists that Iran's economic indicators are not dire and that government revenues have not yet fallen. He goes on to argue that Iran is engaged in an economic and psychological war with its enemies, including the United States, causing the drop in the rial's value on the black market. The U.S. is due to begin reimposing economic sanctions gradually against Iran in the coming months, following U.S. President Donald Trump's decision in May to withdraw from the JCPOA. The five remaining signatories of the deal have been locked in ongoing discussions with Tehran over the future of the agreement. Iran's parliament speaker, Ali Larijani, discussed the fallout of the United States' withdrawal from the joint nuclear deal with the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, plus Germany, known as the JCPOA, in a speech Monday to lawmakers. He says there are differences of opinion in Iran about the importance of the nuclear deal with the United States, and some would like Iran to renegotiate with the U.S. He claims, though, the U.S. is not a trustworthy negotiator, and it has reneged on numerous agreements, including the Paris Climate Accord, as well as withdrawing from UNESCO and the UN Human Rights Council. Iranian media reported that the ringleaders of Monday's protests have been placed under arrest. It was not immediately clear how many people were detained. Iranian security forces fired tear gas at protesters Monday, but there were no reports of casualties. Former Iranian President Abul Hassan Bani Sadr, who lives in exile in France, tells VOA that he doubts the reimposition of sanctions on Tehran is behind the current economic crisis in the country. He says that the U.S. has said it will reimpose sanctions over a period of 3 to 6 months, so there are absolutely no concrete economic reasons for the Iranian currency to have lost so much of its value in such a short period of time. Bani Sadr said there are political factors within the Iranian regime itself which are catalysts in the current crisis. He says the country's military economic mafia is deliberately provoking a serious crisis in order to take control of the government and force new presidential elections. This, he believes, is a strategy to maintain control during the upcoming succession of the aging supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. President Donald Trump will award the Medal of Honor, the military's highest award for heroism, to deceased Army First Lieutenant Garland Merle Connor more than 70 years after he fought in World War II. He was wounded 7 times in battle, and in January 1945, Connor raced ahead of American lines to call in artillery strikes on an overwhelming onslaught of German forces outside Hussein, France. His wife, Pauline Connor, will accept the award Tuesday on his behalf. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb brings us the story of this brave American soldier.
When Pauline Connor first saw her future husband, Garland Merle Connor, shortly after World War II had ended in 1945, she didn't quite understand why the town was making such a big deal about such a scrawny guy.
I said to Mother, my God, that little wharf rat, he couldn't have done all they said he done. Because he was standing there so small. But in about a month later, I married him.
They lived a quiet, simple life on a Kentucky farm. Connor never talked about his actions outside Housen, France, or any of the other battles he fought across North Africa and Europe. He is the second most decorated service member of World War II. But his cousin Luther Connor tells VOA he never even displayed his medals in his home.
They were literally in a cardboard box in his old army duffel bag in the bottom of the closet, in a living room closet.
Major General Lee Quintus, the current commander of Connor's army division, told VOA the young first lieutenant wasn't even supposed to be on the battlefield that day.
He was wounded. He was shot in the hip by a sniper prior to this event. And he escaped from the hospital, essentially, rejoined his unit, and the battalion commander said, hey, we're going to keep you at the battalion headquarters. I'm going to make you the battalion intelligence officer to give you some time to recover because you've been injured. So this attack comes, and he volunteers to go to the front.
Connor, with nothing but a gun and a phone line, dashed onto the battlefield, holding off 600 Germans and six tanks coming at him as he called in artillery strikes from a shallow ditch. Military historian Eric Villard.
So he was out in front of the American lines, and the German infantry at one point, you know, got within 10 meters of his position. And the last phase of the assault, he basically called artillery on himself.
Connor proved more than just a scrawny Kentucky farm boy, making his phone line the deadliest instrument on the battlefield as both German and American firepower bore down around him. Again, Major General Lee Quintus.
On that particular day and that particular moment in time, I believe he was the most important person. His ability to call for fire, his ability to control that part of the battle was absolutely essential to the division winning the fight that day.
Pauline Connor never learned the full depth of her husband's bravery until after he died at the age of 79. A team, including Pauline and Connor's cousin Luther, fought for nearly 20 years after Connor passed away to get his Distinguished Service Cross upgraded to the Medal of Honor. An upgrade made possible by the eyewitness accounts of three of Connor's fellow soldiers buried deep within records at the National Archives. And now, Pauline says, she's proud her husband is getting the recognition he deserves.
He was my hero. I loved him very much. And I just so thankful that I get to see this in my lifetime.
Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
What a story. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. India State and Urban Initiative, led by the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Wadhwani Chair in U.S. India Policy Studies, and the CSIS Energy and National Security Program, recently announced three new projects with the state government of Maharashtra, India, as part of the initiative's ongoing work. CSIS has been the implementing partner of the U.S. Department of State in carrying out the initiative since September 2016. The goal of the U.S. India State and Urban Initiative is to build productive energy partnerships between Indian and United States subnational entities, such as state governments, cities, industry, research institutions, and civil society. Under this initiative, the government of Maharashtra and the California-based Network for Global Innovation will sign an agreement to develop a clean tech incubator ecosystem in Maharashtra to accelerate adoption of sustainable technologies and encourage growth of trade and investment of these technologies. The Georgia Institute of Technology will launch a new pilot research project to understand the consumer dynamics and consumers' responsiveness to adoption of new technologies in the electricity sector in Maharashtra. The city of Pune in Maharashtra was recognized as India's first lighthouse city as a result of a Grand Challenge competition lost in 2017 by the National Institution for Transforming India and Colorado-based Rocky Mountain Institute. A lighthouse city has demonstrated that it has smart urban development with population density of greater than 1 million that needs diverse modes of passenger transportation. The Lighthouse City is supported by an urban mobility lab that will be initially hosted by the Pune Municipal Corporation starting in August 2018. The lab will advance the design, integration, and implementation of new solutions for complex transportation challenges, as well as how these ideas can be replicated and scaled throughout India. The goal is to demonstrate ways to upgrade transportation services to meet the needs of rapidly growing cities while showing operational efficiency and reduction of pollution, congestion, and petroleum demand. These announcements were made during the visit of Sri Devendra Fudnavis, Honorable Chief Minister of Maharashtra, to Washington, D.C., when he attended a public forum on June 14th, co-hosted by the CSIS Wadhwani Chair and the India Initiative at Georgetown University to outline his vision for the state of Maharashtra. The initiative strongly supports U.S. government policy to promote energy security, economic development, and energy sector reform in India. The United States is proud to work with India and with private sector partners to help India achieve its ambitious energy goals.